Yeah, we'll begin Mezes Hashem, continuing on the subject of Shalom Aleichem that we started last time. We saw last time how he was crowned. His ability, etc. We discussed the virtues of his humility in terms of his own personal story as an individual, and the challenge for him to overcome that humility as a king. And what we left off last time was that, sorry, what we left off last time was that he, technological trouble. He was crowned. There was a whole celebration of his crowning. Not everybody was so excited about him because, as we discussed, the people who were asking for a king were looking for that charismatic, confident personality. Whereas, if the Shmuel acquiesced and said, "I'm going to bring you a king," he came back bringing them a very unassuming person who was just trying to hide, and people were like, this wasn't what we wanted. We were figuring out the figures of the monarchs of the other nations, and he bought them a timid yeshiva bacher. But this was part of the point. Part of the point was Hashem decides who is the king. As Hashem says later, Ha'odam yirah le'inayim v'Hashem yirah le'leva. And Shaul was crowned king. What happened at that point? At that point, as we remember, Shaul went back home, like regular, didn't set up a court, went back home, continued taking care of his father's livestock. And if you wanted to know what is the king doing at 2 in the afternoon, he was out in the fields driving the oxen. Now, at this point, it was still was kind of like in between. Like there was a king, there wasn't a king. He was already officially crowned as king. And it also says that there were people who, of their own accord, decided to accompany him and kind of made themselves be his court, even though he hadn't set up a court. And this is where we're standing at this point. And then an event happened that turned it all around. So what happens? In Perek Aleph, the story continues, and the nations around, word starts getting around, news. The nation of Israel, that up until that point, you had these different nations around, and they didn't understand the spiritual dynamics and workings of Bnei Israel. They knew that Bnei Israel are basically a vulnerable, unprotected country. And all of a sudden, word starts spreading that there's a king, that they anointed a king. This sparked reactions in the neighboring nations. And the first one to really react was Nachash HaAmoni, Nachash, the king of Ammon. He was bothered by the fact, angered by the fact that the Bnei Israel had the gumption to crown a king. So he came immediately to challenge the new king, to make sure that the Bnei Israel would not start, putting themselves on the map. So he came immediately to challenge the new king. And he specifically came and camped against the area of Yavesh Gilead. Yavesh Gilead was an area of Binyamin. This was the Shevet of Shaul, and he dafka came to start up, not just with the Jewish people, but with Shaul's Shevet, in order to just assert, don't think that you can do anything. Remember who the real bosses of the area are. Nachash, the king of Ammon, king of Ammon. And basically, nobody wanted to fight him. Again, the Jewish people were still in a mindset of we don't have an army. Nobody wanted to fight him. They were scared. And the people of Yavesh Gilad came out and told him, okay, we're ready to surrender and pay you a tribute. But he didn't want a tribute and he didn't want to surrender. He wanted to make his point. So he told them, you know what my terms of surrender are? That I will gouge out everyone in Yavesh Gilad's right eye. Then I'll accept your surrender. So they respond to him. They said, I mean, they understood that he's coming to challenge. Usually, if an army wants to attack and you tell them, give us some time to organize an army, right? The offender isn't interested. That's why he's attacking now. But here, since his whole point was he wanted to come and show you guys can't do anything against me. So on the contrary, they told him, give us a week to see if we can gather aid. And he said, fine. This was exactly what he was trying to show. Fine. He granted them that. Okay. So what happens? So they sent a delegation. Lamaisa, we have a king now. They didn't know what he could do. As far as they knew, right? This was the timid yeshiva bacher who went back to herding his father's cattle. But they have a king now. There's an address. They sent a message to him. They sent a message to him. He wasn't home. When the delegation arrived, he wasn't home. He was out with the oxen. This is what the pasuk tells us. He was out with the oxen. And then it says, he came back home. They told him the story. And all of a sudden, the timid Shaul takes on a whole new persona. And the pasuk tells us, this following pasuk shows a whole shift in his disposition for everything we've been seeing up till now. Vatitzlach ruach Elokim al Shaul. Spirit of Hashem came over Shaul, kishama yis hadvarim eile, as he heard these things. Vayichar apoy mo'oy. And he grew very angry. And here we see how, in the double sense, first of all, against facing off against the enemy, but also at the same time, immediately and suddenly asserting his authority over the Bnei Yisrael. All of a sudden, this timid man comes and says, but not just says, in almost a violent way, what he did was he took cattle, cut it into pieces, like a very stark demonstration, sent the pieces of dismembered cattle all around the different cities of Eretz Yisrael. Everybody got a piece of a dead ox delivered to their area, and he said, this is what is going to the cattle of anybody who doesn't come join. This is what his cattle is going to look like. This is the message that this timid young man is sending out to all of Israel.
New form of draft.
What's that? A new form of draft. That's right. That's right. And it says, Vayipol pachad Hashem alo. So, a very interesting thing. How did they respond? It doesn't say that they were scared of losing their cattle. It says, Vayipol pachad Hashem alo. That was how they responded. Pachad of Hashem fell on them. Meaning what? This wasn't about the cattle. It was about, as we already discussed, the ideal role of the king. The way the king should be playing out is that he is simply a representative of Hashem toward the people. And all of a sudden, this hit them. They saw the ruach. They saw the assertion that he didn't seem to have earlier in his personality. And they understood that this is not about them and Shaul. This is about them and Hashem, the representative of Hashem, which Shaul was stepping into that role. And therefore, they responded not with pachad of Shaul, but with pachad of Hashem. This is a beautiful thing. This is exactly how we want it to be. And they joined. They all gathered together to join Shaul. Okay? And we're not going to go through the whole story. Shaul gathered the nation together, went out, and basically wiped away the army of Nachash. And all of a sudden, all the people are looking at Shaul differently, as are the nations looking at Shaul differently. And now Shmuel says, okay, now let's go again and make a new coronation. We made the coronation before, but not everybody bought into it. Now we're going to make a new coronation. And this coronation was already of a whole different nature. It says, they all went together back to Gilgal. A new coronation. They crowned Shaul again. They bought many offerings, meaning they made it into a big festival. This time was a very great celebration. And then from here, it just moves ahead. Shaul at this point goes ahead and actually does set up a court, actually at two different places, moved between Michmash and Har Beis El. Okay. Now already the royal court is being set up. Things are being set up in a more organized way, and things go to the next stage. So this started with Shaul defending the people against the threat. But now Shaul is moving to the next stage. And here's where we see Yoinasan, Shaul's great son, moving onto the scene. See, at this point, the Bnei Yisrael, like as we discussed, up till now they were in something of a vulnerable state. They were essentially, materially, they were defenseless up until this point. And the Plishtim were the main ruling force in Eretz Yisrael right now. At this point in time, the Plishtim were the main ruling force in Eretz Yisrael, and the Bnei Yisrael were kind of like subject to them. I don't know if it was official, not official, but the reality was that the Plishtim were the ruling force. And it was to the extent that Jewish people at this point couldn't even own weapons. Not only couldn't they own weapons, they weren't allowed to have any sort of metal sharpener, something to sharpen metal keli, such that if a Jew wanted to sharpen his plow or his axe that he wanted to use for cutting trees or whatever his saw, he had to go do it by the Plishtim. That was the way it worked. And certainly nobody owned weapons. The Plishtim made sure of that. Nobody owned weapons. And anybody who wanted to have his thing sharpened had to do the Plishtim, and they specifically would do it in a inferior kind of way. So there were no proper weapons among Klal Yisrael. Except the only people who had weapons was Shaul and Yonasan. They each had swords. Yonasan went ahead and he starts moving the next. We're going to be asserting the Jewish monarchy now. So he went ahead and assassinated the Plishti governor who was in Geva, which was basically what this was a declaration of war against the Plishti rule, a declaration that we're not subordinate to the Plishtim anymore. And that was how the Plishtim responded. They came, they gathered their forces to come against the Jewish people, and in turn, Shaul was now gathering the Bnei Yisrael to go come out against the Plishtim. Here at this point, okay, it was wonderful when Shaul rallied people together and defended them, but now Shaul is calling on the whole nation to join him against the powerful Plishtim who had been ruling the people. So here, basically, not so pashut. Many people just preferred to go hide out. People ran away from their homes. Everybody was panicking now. It's kind of like, well, reminiscent of the Hashmonaic uprising against the Greeks. But people were not so confident about what was happening here, about Shaul and Yonasan challenging the Plishti rule. And many people actually went into hiding. Many people simply fled from Eretz Yisrael. People ran away. And Shaul is gathering a force to fight the Plishtim. I'm not going to get into the whole story, but basically what happened was, just to keep it short, well, there's a lot of different dynamics here. That as Shaul is gathering his army and the Plishtim are coming up against Shaul, Yoinasan went with a small group of people with him. Not a small group, with his one aide, with his one assistant. Yonasan went with his one assistant, circled around the Plishti camp. And again, not getting into all the details now, but deserves to be studied perhaps another time. Yonasan took on the Plishti camp by himself. He made a surprise attack. And basically, while Shaul didn't even know what was happening. Yonasan just kind of slipped off. And while Shaul is still busy organizing the army, Yonasan came around from the back together with his attendant. They made their way into the Plishti camp and just started killing. Now, meanwhile, Shaul and his people, who were still gathering together, suddenly they said the people who were looking out, the scouts, not the scouts, people who are on the lookout to see what's going on in the enemy camp, they suddenly saw what had been orderly ranks. Suddenly, everything was falling apart, and they saw the Plishti camp was starting to flee in all directions. Nobody understood what was happening. Nobody knew what was happening except that they saw that the Plishti camp was falling apart. So Shaul and his men attacked. And basically, the bottom line was that they creamed the Pelishti army. There was a few incidents that took place here, but again, I'm not going to focus on them now. And this was really what began a new era. A new era. All of a sudden, the Jewish people have a king, they have an army, and he is starting to impose his fear on the nations around. After he dealt with Nachash, the king of Ammon, and after he dealt with the Plishtim, what happens afterwards is at this point, Shaul had consolidated his rule. And he continued with there to make battles against the various threats that had been surrounding Eretz Yisrael until now. And until now, there was nobody addressing him. Like I said, it was like on an as-needed basis that a Shefid would come. Now he went and proactively went out against Moab, Ammon, Edom, Tzoiva, Plishtim. And the Pasuk says, B'chol asher yifneh yarshia. Wherever he turned, he wreaked havoc. Vayas chayil. He basically rebalanced the whole reality in the whole area at that point by asserting himself as a very powerful, mighty king who was somebody to be feared by all the nations around. And now the Bnei Israel found themselves with a consolidated rule by a very righteous king, with all the nations around fearing them.
Where the weapons come from? The weapons, how are they doing?
How did they do that? Well, after they beat the Plishtim, that all changed.
They
Oh, so they beat the Plishtim. Yonasan with his sword did much of the work. Shaul had his sword, and everybody else went with half-sharpened pitchforks. They were continuing. That was how battles always worked in the time of the Shoftim. Here, it's in stages. But yeah, that was exactly part of why they're being shown that they still needed Hashem. Yes. That's right. So they went out with pitchforks, they went out with whatever it is they had, which were half sharpened, and this is what happened. Hashem was with him.
They could also take the swords from the dead Plishtim.
Once they beat the Plishtim, then presumably they already had a supply, and now they can stop making their own. That's right. Okay. So then we move on to what is one of the most poignant stories in Shaul's history. And here's where I want to slow down and actually look at this story properly. This is a tragic story. And of course, we're talking about the command of Hashem to go battle against Amalek. So after Shaul has asserted his reign and has asserted his might, he's recognized by the people as their monarch, he's recognized by the neighbors around as a formidable force to contend with. Now Shmuel comes with a new message of Hashem. And he comes with like a dramatic declaration. I see Shalach Hashem l'moshchacho melech al amo Yisrael. Hashem sent me to anoint you as the king. And in that context, I'm coming with something that is significant. This is one of the most significant roles that you're going to play out as a king. And what is that? To wipe out Amalek.
I interrupt. That's the story of Benjamin coming.
Oh, that's later on. That's later on. This is before David appears on the scene. So Hashem comes, and basically the order is go and wipe out Amalek. But there are a few added details to the command. Hacharamto es kol asher loy. Wipe out everything they have. Which means don't take any spoils, don't leave any survivors. Like Tachmololov, have no mercy. Veimato me'ish ad isha me'elil v'ad yonik. Wipe out men, women, children, babies, every last person. And also, mishor v'ad se migomol v'ad chamor. Wipe out all of the livestock. Leave absolutely no survivors, but included also is get rid of all the valuables. Why? So, well, we're all familiar with the Maamar of Chazal that they could turn themselves, some of the Plishtim could turn themselves into animals through Kishuv, But the simple understanding of this was that Hashem wanted it to be clear that this was not a battle of conquest. This was not about spoils. It's not what this was about. This was about the principle. This was about avenging the evil that Amalek was. That this was about simply getting rid of them. That was the purpose of the war. Okay? Shaul goes ahead, rallies the people together, but he's struggling. He's struggling a bit. He's struggling a bit. The truth is, you say he's struggling. If there's one mitzvah in the Torah that perhaps we all struggle with, what is it? Isn't it this command to wipe them all out? Not to wait till a person is guilty. You see a little baby of Amalek commanded to wipe him out. And not only that, but also the command to wipe out every last animal. Chazal tell us that Shaul was struggling with this because we see in other mitzvahs the immense regard that we have for a life. And what happens here? See, he was having a hard time. Now, did that stop him from going ahead? Didn't stop him from going ahead. But he's having a hard time with it. This is where Chazal say that Hashem applied the pasuk that says, "Al titzdak harbe." Don't be overly righteous. What do we mean by don't be overly righteous? In a general way, we would say, be overly righteous. That's the simple klal. If you're righteous, be even more righteous. And if you're even more righteous, be even more righteous. But when the pasuk says, don't be overly righteous, what it means is, don't be more moral than Hashem.
What do you know? Can you tell me the wording in the passage?
Al titzdak harbe.
Saying.
What's that? So this actually, the pasuk itself was really codified much later, Shlomo HaMelech. But it says that Hashem was already applying this pasuk to Shlomo HaMelech. Hashem is applying this pasuk to Shlomo HaMelech, and Chazal tell us that this pasuk is to be applied to Shlomo HaMelech. Don't be more moral than Hashem. Don't be, we'll call it politically correct, emotionally correct, moral, where Hashem says otherwise. No. No. I'm saying the perspective that Chazal gave on this, that there's a criticism being leveled against Shaul's feelings here, which we'll see coming out more explicitly as we go along.
But he did give someone a lie.
Oh, that's what's coming. That's what's coming. In fact, we'll say it a bit more. The command to wipe out Amalek holds a certain valuable lesson. Because again, it goes against the grain. Torah is all the time moving us in this direction, right? And all of a sudden, the command to wipe out Amalek comes and pushes against that whole current. All the mitzvahs of the Torah are about kindness, compassion, sensitivity, etc., etc. And here we have this command. There are a few other such commands, but this, I guess, epitomizes it. And there's a very, very important lesson here. And that is that it's a very big principle when it comes to midas. We often think in terms of good midas versus bad midas. But the truth is that that's a misnomer. When we say a good midah, what does the word midah mean? The word midah means what? A measure. Why? Because we're talking about all kinds of different human traits, human qualities and characteristics. And the whole concept of Avodas HaMidos is know in what measure to use which midah. So when we talk about something as a good midah, what we mean is you're supposed to use it most of the time. That's what a good midah is. When we talk of something as a bad midah, we mean that 98% of the time, don't use it. It's meant to be used in a very small measure. Now, why is this so important? The reason this is so important is that midas are not supposed to take us over. They're not supposed to control us. We are meant to be harnessing our midos and cultivating them in the service of Hashem. A part of that demands of us to be able, at Hashem's command, to say, I've been working for 50 years to cultivate this midah, and now Hashem comes and says, do the opposite. And this is really where the Oyved Hashem, the true servant of Hashem, is really tested. And this was the story of Avraham Avinu, right? This was the story of the command of the Akedah. To an extent, this is the story of Mitzvah Smila. And this is part of the value behind the Mitzvah of Mechiyas HaMalek. Now, it has its reasons as to why Hashem wants this nation wiped out. But in terms of the command, the demand that it places on us the understanding that Hashem wants you to be a compassionate person, but all within the framework of his command. And that's why, you know, the Rambam says that people should strive for the middle path, to go the Derech HaEmtza, the middle path. By the way, that is one of the most misconstrued statements of the Rambam. People extend it to mean that in Yiddishkeit in general, you should go middle of the path. Don't be too into Yiddishkeit. Be moderate, right? They just ask a simple question. How would that work in a relationship? What if your husband would tell you, I love you to an extent, but I believe in the middle path. So I love you in moderation. So lukewarm. You bounce him out, right? No. Avodas Hashem, our Yiddishkeit, is meant to be a passionate, all the way sort of activity. I'm just putting this parenthetically. The Rambam is talking about midas. That's where he says, go on the middle path. Midas, meaning all of your different traits, all of your different instincts, all of your different passions, operate with them on the middle path. And let me tell you that if you want to get to a place of Avodas Hamidas in the middle path, you have to have an extreme approach to Avodas Hamidas. If you have a moderate approach to Avodas Hamidas, you will never achieve the middle path because the middle path is hard work. The middle path in Midas. I don't know if it's clear what I'm saying. Everybody understand my point? To get to a place of middle path, if we think about all the different Midas, laziness versus energy, stinginess versus generosity, kas versus calm, et cetera, if you really want to get to a middle path with all these things, you better not have a middle path approach to Avodas Hamidas because you won't get anywhere. You have to have a passionate, extreme approach. And I want to go on Avodas Hamidas to the extreme. Okay, now that deserves a lot of elaboration, but it's not our subject. I'm sorry. That's right. And that's actually our point. Midas, the whole approach is meant to be under the control, under the rule of the Seichel. So what does the middle path mean? Or let's take another a step further. Okay, so Midas is supposed to be in the middle path. So here, Bichel Yaakovson, one of my rebbes, he expressed it like this. Are Midas supposed to be in the middle path? That means that you do everything 50%. Is that how it works? Right? Someone approaches you for tzedakah, one time you give, one time you don't. One time you give, one time you don't. Or just make it simpler and give away 50% of your money. The middle path means something else. It means something more profound. Picture, this is really how it is. You're walking down the road and you have a vacuum pulling you on either side. There's generosity pulling you in this direction and stinginess pulling you in this direction. You have kas pulling you in this direction and calm pulling you in the other direction. Energy versus laziness. You're being pulled, right? And you're standing like this, and you're teetering. Middle path means that you should be capable of standing in the middle, not being pulled this way and not being pulled that way, and deciding, now I am choosing to turn to the right and follow that midah. Now I'm deciding to turn to the left and follow that midah. Now, having said that, you take midas like, let's take the midah of rachmanis versus cruelty, insensitivity, callousness. So here Hashem says, be in the middle path, be in control, and utilize that midah of rachmanis 99.5% of the time. Choose the midah of rachmanis and be cultivating the midah of rachmanis. But you still have to be on the middle path. You can't let it take control of you. Most of the time, go with it. Go with the flow. Let the midah of Rachmanis control you, but still holding the reins in your hand and capable of reclaiming the reins at the moment Hashem says and saying, now, no. We all know this. As parents, we know this. If you're only going to follow your Midah Rachmanis, you're going to raise wild animals. So we know that sometimes you do need to catch the reins and do something that goes against the grain of that wonderful Midah Rachmanis. Now, if you are going to be controlled by a Midah, and you're not going to be capable of working against it, much better to be controlled by the Midah Rachmanis than by the Midah of Achzorius, right? And we'll call it a very Jewish fault if you can't overcome your Rachmanis. And we will certainly admire a person much more if they can't overcome their Rachmanis than if they can't overcome their Achzorius. But yet, we're pulling it all into the framework of Avodas Hashem and saying, at the end of the day, whatever Midah it is, it's a Midah. Meaning, you're supposed to be measuring the extent to which you're applying it and applying it as dictated by the ultimate guiding light of what is Ratzon Hashem. What is Ratzon Hashem? That is the ultimate moral compass. So here, and this was also another difference between David and Shaul. David, who knew nothing other than just implementing Ratzon Hashem, often with compassion, and in those instances where that was what was demanded of him, with the opposite. And Shaul is going to go ahead and do it too. But he's struggling with it. And, oh, that's another good example. We're getting on the chat here of Avraham Avinu, who's told to send out, right, Hagar and Ishmael. So now, we close the parentheses, we come back. Shaul goes out, he wages the battle, and a major success. He simply wipes out Amalek. Let's remember, everybody knows the story, it's very quick. He wiped out Amalek, but he left Agob and the cattle. But think to yourself that wiping out is not an easy thing to do. It's not like you just get up and wipe someone out. You're talking about a battle against the nation. When you go out to battle, you don't know what's going to happen, right? There's apprehension. If we see that Shaul and the Bnei Yisrael wiped up all of them, we quickly jump to, but except for Agob, we have to take a step back for a minute in order to appreciate to really get into the dynamic of what was going on then. If they wiped out all of Amalek except for Agob and the livestock, then they were battling with sweat and blood, and they really put themselves to it. They put themselves to Hashem's command with intense dedication and passion. This was the experience. And by the time it was done, they were feeling very fulfilled. They were feeling very satisfied. Look, this command has been hanging throughout the generations, and look, we've bought it. Let's place. Okay, we still have Agag. He's in chains. He's under our control. For all practical purposes, Amalek is eradicated. And there's the livestock. The livestock is alive, meanwhile. Why are the livestock still alive? Well, why just wipe them out? Stop. That would be a waste. We can sacrifice them. We can sacrifice them. We're going to hold on to the choicest among the livestock. We can sacrifice them. Especially since Shaul was the one who actually got the command. But all the nation, when they went to battle, and now they're suddenly told to wipe out the livestock, but wait, here are very high quality things. And Shaul, still with his humility, with as much as he became a monarch, still with his humility, he had the people coming and telling him, 1 minute, this doesn't make sense. You know, we can hold on to it. We can do things with this livestock. So he knew that he had the command, but again, this was a fringe part of the command, right? The main command had been carried out in very, very great form. So livestock, okay, we have to figure out what to do with the livestock, and the nation are not going to be pleased if he just wipes out all that quality of livestock. And therefore, Shaul kind of like decided, okay, let's hold off with the livestock. We're going to leave the livestock. We're going to leave the livestock now. I'll say even more than that. Shaul had fired up the nation with enthusiasm, and he didn't want to ruin that enthusiasm. That's what Chasam Sofer explains. So they're done. And what's the feeling among Klal Yisrael now? A feeling of fulfillment, feeling of satisfaction. Meanwhile, what's happening far from there is that Shmuel gets a message, a very harsh message from Hashem. And the harsh message from Hashem is, Nimlachti basically says, I've changed my mind. I don't want Shaul to be the king of Klal Yisrael anymore. I've rejected him because he has rejected my word. Shmuel, who just went through the whole process of putting all that into Shaul and of implementing his reign, presenting him to Klal Yisrael, now he gets this nevuah. So, okay, we're going to have to continue this next week, but let's just continue a little bit into the very poignant next stage of Shmuel actually approaching Shaul. So what happens? So it says, Shaul is standing victoriously with all the people, and you see Shmuel approaching. He knows why Shmuel is coming. Shmuel is coming to congratulate him for this immense feat. And he greets Shmuel festively. He says, Baruch atah Hashem, Hakim Moisi Zva Hashem. You be blessed by Hashem. I fulfilled the command. And how's this for anticlimactic? Vayomer Shmuel, Umakla tsoina ze ba'oznoi v'kol ha'boker ha'shem lifnei shomea. What is the sound of the livestock that I hear? Shaul, and Shaul says, yes, this is the Amaleki livestock. And here already he starts stammering a little bit. Listen how he expresses it. He says, Me'amaleki evyum, he says, the nation, he kind of on the one hand, he's explaining the justification, while on the other hand, he's pinning it on the nation. And he's kind of like starting to feel a little wavery here. He understood the problem there. When Shmuel said, what's with the livestock? He understood the problem. And he said, well, the idea is to sacrifice them. And it was the nation's idea. Okay. So Vayomer Shmuel el Shaul, Heref, stop. Why does he tell him stop? So the first should say something very poignant. Malbim says, Shmuel says, you just ruined it. How did David respond when Shmuel came with accusations? One word, chatasi, immediately. Like, no anything. If Shmuel is coming with a criticism from Hashem, chatasi, now I'm facing it. And Shmuel said, yeah, you're ruining it by justifying, by giving excuses. It's not the way to save the situation. It's not the way to save it. It's not like Hashem is going to say, oh, I hear. If Hashem is coming with a criticism, the only way to address it is by facing it head on and saying, chatasi, this is tough to swallow, especially considering who we're talking about. Okay, we have to leave it in mid-sentence and see where this goes next week.